Hello, listeners. We've got a great interview for you today with a freelance journalist who does a different kind of work than any of us ever have. Out in the field reporting on his favorite subjects, complete with travel and danger and adventure and expense reports. I think you'll love it. But sometimes even the most adventurous freelancer settles in to write an actual book about their topic or all they've seen and done. And going from writing short journalism to structuring and finishing an entire book is hard. But I'll bet you've guessed who could help. Our sponsor, Author Accelerator, can help you find a book coach to get you through that process no matter where you are and what you're working on. To find out more, head to authoraccelerator.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I remember what I was supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause and...
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two.
About writing all the things, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, memoir, proposals, pitches, every week. This is the podcast about sitting down and talking about getting your work done. Actually, it's about sitting down and getting the work done. Talking about the work done, getting the work done, that doesn't feed the bull up.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming The Addiction Inoculation that will be out in April of 2021. And you can find my work at The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and various other outlets. Oh, and at Airmail, where I have a piece coming out pretty soon, actually.
Crazy cakes.
Crazy cakes. And who are you?
Oh, yeah, this is where I introduce myself. I forget... I'm a person who just went to the dentist and got, like, at least good news that nothing catastrophic has to be done to remedy the painful spot on my tooth.
Oh, good.
Still, just the mere fact of having gone and come back for the dentist wipes my brain entirely of everything else.
Well, now that we know all about your teeth.
Severe dental phobia. I know. This is the podcast about KJ's dental phobia. I am the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, which is coming out, we hope, in December of 2020, and of the book How to Be a Happier Parent, out now in hardback and paperback. And I am the former editor of the Motherload blog at the New York Times.
They didn't give you Novocaine, did you? This is just
no,
you.
This
is just KJ.
Just me.
Well, we have a guest today that I am so excited to talk about because I don't get to talk about this very much. I guess I talk about it a little, but I have a severe addiction to not all reality television, but a very specific slice of reality television that has to do with animals. I'm a total at if there, with a few exceptions, if there is a one of those like vet shows, like animal, like. Oh, Michelle Oakley, the, you know, Yukon vet, Dr. Pohl, anything meds or vet school, anything having to do with fixing animals, I am so in. And we don't, I purchase it like on, you know, for example, on Amazon Prime, and then I just binge the whole season. And it's a total addiction for me. And today's guest actually writes in this arena and writes in the arena of reality television. Today, we get to talk to Andy Denhart. Andy Denhart writes about society and the media. He writes about more than just reality television, although that is clearly his passion. And we'll talk with him about that. His work's been all over the place, all things considered, on NPR, Morning Edition, Washington Post, Playboy, The Los Angeles Times, Pacific Standard, and New York Times, all the super duper amazing places. He created the website Reality Blurred so that he could just write about the cool stuff that he loves. And he has actually an origin story for that that's really cool. He also coordinates Stetson University's journalism program and teaches nonfiction writing and journalism. And Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So great to talk to you both.
I am so excited to talk to you. Do you like the vet shows?
I don't watch them regularly, I will say. So I do. Probably my favorite animal adjacent show is My Cat from Hell, which of course should really be called My Owner is a Jerk and Needs to Know How to Take Care of Me.
I actually haven't watched that one. But yeah, if it involves like Alaska taking care of like any large animals, then I am all in. And anyway, so let's do, you have a very cool origin story for how you got started, or at least where the genesis of your passion for reality television comes from. And it came from an unlikely source, Mr. Rogers. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you trace back my love of television and my fascination with sort of how reality TV is made, especially, it has to go to Mr. Rogers, who was basically my first and only friend as a child. And I had a real connection with him. And there was one day when he basically had the cameras spin around and show that his house wasn't real and that this was a studio and there was a piano player sitting right there. And it was sort of amazing and mind-blowing at the same time, and also kind of shattered the illusion. And I don't know how old I was or what I actually expected at that moment. Like, did I really think that this was really his house? But for some reason, that just like, it didn't break up with Mr. Rogers because he'd betrayed me in that way, but it certainly started getting me skeptical about what I watched. And I think, 15 years later or so, when I was watching The Real World in the 90s and became, just fell in love with that and being able to sort of meet other people who were unlike me, that fascination kept, that through line went through to those shows too.
Yeah, I think in the age of DVD, you could get the ones that had the director's commentary on them. I think there, for some DVDs, like in fact, one of my favorites is Sense and Sensibility. Emma Thompson does a director's commentary for that, and it's all this really funny like background stuff. What was going on when they were filming, and the Lord of the Rings background, all for those three movies. My kids have probably listened to the director's commentary as much as they have listened to the actual film itself. So I totally get that, flipping the camera around, flipping the audio around and being able to hear what was going on. Because for me, those stories are so cool. That's like it becomes part of the experience for me. And I would assume, like, for example, and one of the things you've written about a lot recently is how the show Survivor handled the sexual harassment that was going on in the show. I was looking at some of your work, and that's very much, you can't take the two things apart when you're talking about reality television. Since it is reality television, the way the production goes is part of what's happening on the screen. So it's not even like you can put a cloak over all that stuff in the background, get into character, and be free of that when you're filming as a character. This is reality. So the production reality affects the television reality.
Absolutely. But then for most people, and I include myself in that, when you're watching, the view is so singular and we see just what the camera is capturing. And then, of course, what the editors decide to show us. And so it feels like all of that gets erased. But you don't know that all the producers on the beach on Survivor are mostly white men. And when you have incidents as we had last year, from racial slurs being used to sexual harassment, and that definitely is coming to fruition because of what's happening behind the cameras that we don't see. So I love to dive into those stories and try to figure out as much as I can about how these shows are made and how that affects what we see.
So can we talk a little bit about sort of origin stories? Because a lot of our listeners are just starting out, trying to figure out, how to get into the writing gig, how to get their foot in the door. So how did you get started?
So my story is a sordid tale in many ways, which is it starts in, like middle school era, when I just remember hating writing so much that my parents would have to basically rewrite essays for me so I wouldn't fail out of school. And it just like was never the thing I loved to do. So to realize that I came from there to where this is now my vocation and the thing I do every single day is kind of amazing. But it changed in high school when I discovered a journalism class and took that class and just had wonderful teachers who taught me that writing could be meaningful and could affect other people and I could use it to connect with other people and share what I knew and also learn more about the world around me. And then I didn't really get into as much TV as I was watching and reality TV. I never really made that connection until my early 20s in terms of just like, I should write about reality TV and I should write about the thing that I care about, which is interesting because I think and this has been a thing for my entire career, is thinking about like, what should I do that the world will like? And it's like, if I'm trying to please other people, I'm inevitably going to fail at that. So ultimately just doing what I care about is going to be the most successful. And that's turned out to be true in so many ways.
But you are very smart about taking this passion that you are interested in and that you already want to watch and be a part of, which is so the direction people should go in when they're looking for sort of areas to cover, but finding the topical angles on it. You are not just writing why I love to watch reality TV or, you know, what I thought about the most recent season of such and such. You are looking for the things that are happening within that world that are also topical and reflecting what's happening in the rest of the world. And that, I think, is both why you sell it and why it's so good.
Thanks. No, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, I certainly owe that to my training as a journalist and the teachers and editors who taught me along the way. And also it's just kind of what I'm interested in and sort of, you know, I'm a news junkie on some level in terms of just following the news. And it's easy to sort of connect that to what I'm watching for quote unquote entertainment also.
So I have to ask the question because you have an MFA. And so I'm really, a lot of writers in our Facebook group, you know, they usually circulate this question of, you know, I'm thinking about getting an MFA. Should I get an MFA? Will it help me? And you have one. So given what you write about and given the fact that you have an illustrious MFA from Bennington College, what are your thoughts on that? Does the MFA help you? Is it something that you feel like you are using?
Yeah, absolutely. And if anything, I would love to go do another MFA now, because I think just 20 years after I've done the first one, I would benefit from it again. But I also think that I don't think the degree itself is the thing that matters to me. And it certainly hasn't been this like magic key that has caused agents and editors to be pounding down my email inbox and begging me to write books or anything like that. But what it did was connect me with other writers and give me motivation to actually sit down and do the work, as you both talk about so much. And I'm inspired hearing you talk about it, and listening to the podcast will sometimes get me to finally actually sit down and do that writing. So getting into that sort of forced environment where I had regular assignments, but I was also being really challenged and pushed by the faculty that I had to go beyond the kinds of stuff that I'd been writing and to read a lot more. Bennington's program really emphasizes reading. At least back when I was in the program, I think the unofficial or motto was something like, you read 100 books and you write one. and so just, it really did emphasize like how important reading is. So I 100% to my students or to other people who ask me, I would say, absolutely get an MFA if you want to be better as a writer and you want to immerse yourself in that environment. But I also do think there's other ways to do that that probably cost less, that aren't, that may be a little bit, you know, if you don't have a writing community, if you don't have people around you, it's a wonderful way to find that.
KJ, can I ask a question here? Because I'm completely in love with this piece you wrote, Andy, for Playboy about whale wars.
Yes.
And I would love to ask about it, mainly because there's the story that you decided to write, that I'm assuming you had this idea about what you wanted to write about whale wars. And for those of you who are not familiar with whale wars, maybe you could give us a really quick intro to what that is. And then there's the story of what happened to you within the context of reporting the story. And I was curious how, when you're, it's interesting because you're writing about reality television and then your very reporting becomes a part of the story of the reality television. Could you just tell us a little bit about that experience and sort of how that story came about?
Yeah, definitely. So Whale Wars is a documentary reality series that aired on Animal Planet starting in the late 2000s or whatever we're calling that decade. Have we decided what we're calling that decade yet?
No, but oh my,
2000s is right.
Yeah. I loved that show so much. Well, because I thought I was going to be a cetacean biologist when I grew up. So that show, I was all in with that show.
Yeah, and it followed a group of people called Sea Shepherd, who are mostly all volunteers who get on boats. And at least at that time, one of their primary missions was to stop whaling in the Southern Ocean. That was happening mostly by Japan under the guise of research. And so they would sort of put themselves in the way of the whales and the quote unquote researchers who were slaughtering whales. And the show is just kind of following these people, many of whom, because they were not professionals, were kind of bumbling, and there was lots of things that didn't go well and lots of really scary, intense moments. So it's kind of like a thriller of a reality show. And I think it's on Amazon and elsewhere. I highly recommend it. It still certainly holds up.
So good.
So yeah, and I had written one story for an editor at Playboy who reached out to me after reading some things that I'd been writing. And we'd sort of talked about another story, and he was into the show. I really liked it. And I had the opportunity to, because I knew a publicist who worked on the show, to go and visit while they were in production on a new sort of spinoff that was taking place in the Faroe Islands. And they went up, like Sea Shepherd went up there to try to stop their whale slaughter activity, which is much more based in tradition and food consumption than Japanese whaling in the Southern Ocean is. So it's actually interesting that you said sort of like in terms of like the story about what happened to me, because as much as proud of I am of that story, and as much as I really think it held up, I think I didn't really write the real story of how terrified I was to go there, about how I had a panic attack in the airport before I even got on the plane, being convinced that either Sea Shepherd would kill me or I would be arrested for helping them because I was on board the boat as well. And I left all of that stuff out, and I'm actually now writing it as part of a memoir I'm working on about my ambivalence.
Oh, that's
about
exciting.
My work. And so it's interesting because, like, yeah, there's
well, and there's no one involved in that show on either side of the debate, even the people not involved in the show. There's no one easygoing that's involved in that show. They're all very strong personalities, and there's a lot of danger involved.
Absolutely. And it's, and to then, like, sort of, you know, get on the boat, and they were like, my life is in their hands, essentially. And it turned out to be perfectly easy, perfectly fine. And there was no problems at all in terms of reporting the story once I was there. And they were very open and about talking to me. And so it was just a fantastic experience, but also one that was fraught in all kinds of ways too. And I ended up on the show sort of accidentally, because I was just standing on the outside of the boat and the crews were filming from shore, and I didn't know that. Usually I'm really good about staying out of the way of cameras when they're filming on a set. There I am sort of standing next to Paul Watson, the founder of Sea Shepherd and one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, in a brief moment in Faroe Island. So that's my television claim to fame, which is very minimal.
Can we just pause the story just for a minute mm-hmm. to talk about pitching this to an editor with the amount of expenses that must have been involved? How does that work?
Yeah, I think it was... my editor at Playboy was just very willing to...
And what year was this? And that matters too.
2008 or 2009 somewhere. Or
whoa,
no, sorry.
Okay.
Actually, I'm sorry. It's a little later. 2011. So,
okay,
but
even so,
but yeah,
we're so.
Still,
it's not like it was 2000.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's still like definitely media starting to hurt a little bit in various ways. And so, yeah, they were very generous in terms of being able to pay for the plane flight that was over there. And actually what happened, one of the things that kind of freaked me out, was the night before I was supposed to go, it basically turned out that Sea Shepherd wasn't where they said they were going to be. I was flying to the wrong country, and I wasn't going to be able to even get to the boat, period, because they just got everything wrong related to that. And so I had to buy plane tickets the night before flying to Copenhagen, and then somewhere, and then up to the Faroe Islands. And so Playboy paid for that, which was, of course, in the thousands of dollars. And also generously kind of bumped up my salary for the piece by a few thousand too, because of the sort of physical danger I was going to be in as a freelancer with no insurance and no lawyers or anything, or just going there all by myself, essentially.
That really blows my mind, actually.
Well, so now that everybody wants to write for Playboy, except for the part where nobody wants to write for Playboy.
Yes, exactly.
How did you mentally tackle that? How did you end up pitching Playboy on a whale story in the first place?
So yeah, that's, I mean, it sort of never occurred to me to write for Playboy, both as a gay man and even as a journalist. That was not in my thinking. But I was contacted by an editor a few years earlier and wrote a story about sort of reality TV's effect on the mental health of its participants and sort of how shows take care of and or hurt people. So I went behind the scenes of a show called Hoarders.
Yeah, that was a great piece. Mm-hmm. That was a really good piece too.
Thank you. Yeah. And so it was just after that, I was kind of like searching around for another story. And like, I think what happened was that just happened to align well with like sort of Playboy's mission, at least back then, of targeting men and sort of this, and Animal Planet referred to whale wars as muscular conservation. So I think the audiences aligned well. And it's interesting because like, as much as I remember writing this story, the pitch part felt like it was probably just a conversation and not really like of all the pitches that I've done in the world, in my life. And by the way, like, you know, I've pitched so much and almost every pitch I sent is rejected, and almost, so it's like this is like the one in a thousand.
Yeah, we don't want to leave that out.
Yeah, and it's like that my career is literally a story of failures, and because I think that's what life is and journalism is, and even starting my website was because I got fired from a job of recapping The Real World and felt sad that I couldn't write about reality TV anymore. So I started a site and that's been around for 20 years now. So I think that pitch was probably like, it's funny, I should go look up and see if there's even an email about it or if it was just like a phone call, because I actually can't remember.
Gotcha. The thing that's really interesting to me also about this piece is that it was so wonderfully long, and I'm a huge fan of long form journalism, and it's so rare that we get to sort of sink our teeth into something that's that long and that involved and that much work goes into it. So, you know, that the price point for your pay for this is commensurate with the amount of work that went into it, which doesn't often happen. So bravo to you.
Thanks. Yeah. And I don't know if you want me to talk about that, I'm glad to, because I think that's something that we need to be more transparent about, is just like how much pieces pay.
Yeah.
Piece paid ultimately $10,000 total after that sort of quote unquote bonus or whatever. When I talk to students or other journalists or groups about, and I mention that, that's a shockingly high number, and it feels high to me even now. Like, you get $10,000 for winning Chopped, and I certainly didn't even make any tasty dishes. But I also spent about 5 months on that. So if you sort of work that out to how much that would be over an annual salary, like it doesn't really shape up. Plus that, of course, is before taxes. So a huge chunk of that goes away.
On the flip side, when I tell people about my pay at, you know, when I first started at the freelancing for the Atlantic and the New York Times, my pay was, depending on the publication, between like $100 and $150. And I was spending, you know, it's higher than that now, but I was spending, you know, 25 hours researching and writing a piece that paid me $100, $150. So, you know. Yeah, it's when you talk about a number like $10,000, I mean, that just to me just blows the top of my head off. But then absolutely, you break it down into the research and the travel and the amount of and the peril of the whole thing. It's absolutely what you should get paid for something like that.
Yeah, and it's certainly, I've never been paid anywhere close to any story for it, and I probably won't ever again in my life, I imagine. Like, that might be an era of the past in journalism, but I'm certainly grateful for it. And also, you know, again, really proud of that story, and also looking forward to sort of telling the other side of it as I work on this book.
Well, and I want to turn to your website, definitely. But before we leave the Whale Wars story, I have to say that not only did you get paid for that, what you should have been paid for that, and it's a beautiful long form story, but they commissioned original art and it's gorgeous. Like, there's this extra level, and it's happened to both of KJ and I a couple of times where like some really special art has been commissioned for your piece. And it feels just next level special when you get something really pretty to go with your story. And the art attached to your article is just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, it really was. And just to open it up and see my words next to that is, and, yeah. You know, especially in print, which is kind of rare now, but just really, really beautiful. And I'm, yeah, just honored to have had that opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, let's just KJ. Can't let go of the fact that it's in print in Playboy, though. So this is great. It is beautiful art.
Playboy? I read Playboy for the articles, KJ. I don't know what you're talking about. It's beautiful pieces.
Yeah. I think it's just that's the elephant. Like, we can't not talk about that. Sure. And I don't mean this is not like, it's not a hack job here. I just think, Playboy is.
Playboy.
Yeah.
It's iffy at best in terms of its morality, and I would have to go way farther than that. But I don't want to, I didn't actually realize that we were going to be talking about this, so I didn't prepare you. But I feel like I would be remiss in not just trying to talk a little bit about what happened. It's kind of I don't want to get political. And I suppose that I would certainly write for a website. Okay, I have written for, that Christian newspaper. I forget the name. And I am not Christian, so
I wrote for a Republican governor. I wrote a speech for a Republican governor. Speeches for a Republican governor.
No, there, you just made it political.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying in terms of, like, people who just have different viewpoints or maybe than you do. And I think that, you know, at a certain point, we're talking about, you know, the ability to have an audience for your writing. And I don't want to put any words in Andy's mouth, absolutely. But, you know, for me, it's an interesting, especially for a big paycheck for a great piece.
Tell us what you thought about doing it for them.
Well, and I certainly know that Playboy has a really long tradition of extraordinary journalism and writing. And they also have a really long tradition of objectification of women. And those two things feel in competition, but they also, I was able to, I guess, compartmentalize it and think mm-hmm. about, like, you know, yes, I want to be part of this. I want to, like, I'm sure it fed my ego in many ways and still does to be published in the magazine that so many other great writers have been as well. I know Playboy is very different today in terms of their mission, even though they still publish, or I don't know if they're even in print anymore, but I know at least that they've become more progressive over the last decade. So would I do that again today? Maybe not. And I think just my own privilege or thinking about just, like, I can compartmentalize that and be like, I'm just writing a piece and I am dealing with an editor and I am not contributing to the rest of it. But it's also very awkward because I have copies of the magazine and it's, you know, that's I don't take them to class and show them off for sure.
Look, Mom.
Yeah, exactly.
Framed on the wall.
That is challenging. Yeah. But it is. It's a gorgeous piece and their publication values are strong.
Yeah.
Values. I mean like the physical, yeah, like, you know, the ink and the pages and all that stuff. They pay attention to that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
All right, we can abandon that.
All right, let's
but
go.
I didn't want our listeners to think we didn't
I totally am with
we
you.
Didn't want
that.
To talk about it cuz
No, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that as someone who writes about reality TV and then also looks at all the damage this genre has wrought across our society. I think it's done a lot of tremendous good, and not just in terms of providing entertainment, but also in terms of showing people for who they really are, helping to normalize the idea of LGBTQ people on television, for example. But also, I think reality TV has done a lot of damage in all kinds of ways, not to get political, but there's certainly, tendrils that come out of this. And so I think, you know, and that's at least something, and that's kind of part, again, not to come back to this, like, I'm doing this work now, but I'm thinking a lot about that as I work on this memoir and, like, what all of that means. And I don't know if I have good answers for it at the moment.
This is a very ripe area for discussion, which is really good for memoir, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially yeah. since some of the more recent stuff you've been writing about has been, you know, the unwanted touching stuff at the and Survivor and how the producers didn't do anything about it. And then when they did do, quote unquote, something about it, it was so wishy-washy and ineffectual. And so you really explore all of that and in terms of how the show handled that. And you really took them to task for that, which is interesting given the context that we were just talking about with Playboy. I mean, how do those two things fit together as a writer, you know, and as a creative person? That's an interesting question to face, and a challenging yeah. question to face.
And then I think in entertainment journalism too, like some other kinds of journalism, there's a lot of questions about access. And I have had my access cut off in various ways because networks, publicists, people who work on shows have decided that they don't want someone asking questions or they don't like what I have written. And so that can have interesting consequences. It can also, but it also, like, you know, I think a lot of producers and other people really do appreciate it and appreciate that someone is saying this kind of stuff publicly that they can't because their livelihoods depend upon it. So I'm glad to do what I can and try to elevate those voices and bring those issues to the forefront. And like, even this summer, like I wrote a lot about Cops and Live PD before both of those were canceled and how they both contribute to systemic racism and just our perception of other people. And it's something that is, I think, new for a lot of people to be thinking about.
Well, that begs a question then that I'm really curious about, because there was a memoir that came out of, oh, Bachelor Nation came out a while ago, and the woman made it really clear that she had, her access to Bachelor producers had been cut off because it was really clear that she was asking questions and telling stories that the Bachelor people did not want told. So you're in a bit of a predicament where the more honest and sort of probing you are with your journalism around reality television, the more you lose access to the very places that you're trying to report. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I really do respect that Bachelor Nation was written by Amy Kaufman. And she and I have similar stories, her with The Bachelor. And for me, that's with Survivor, which I covered on location for a year and a half in Africa, in Brazil, I went to Samoa. And covering those and like that was amazing, and I got to learn so much. And then CBS cut off my access to those shows because they didn't, you know, I was going beyond the sort of publicity that they were hoping to get. I guess I was going too deep behind the scenes and asking questions, and I don't even really know. But I think that's one of the things that I can't stop doing, is asking those questions and trying to be authentic to my own thoughts about things and my curiosity, and just letting that guide me, even if it does end up hurting me. And I realize, like, I can say that there's a lot of privilege that comes with being able to say that. One, that I have a day job as a teacher, so I am not a freelancer who's dependent upon every single story to pay my bills for the week. So that's a huge part of it. But it is absolutely tough, and it's relationships that are tough to navigate sometimes. And I think I'm still learning how to do that, even, you know, now 20 years after starting the site and been after writing about this genre for so long.
Well, one thing our listeners are always curious about is how you balance that day job with the writing. So I would love to have give us a picture of how much time you spend on your teaching and you're preparing for teaching, how much time you spend on pitching and trying to get work, and then how much time you're spending on the work itself.
Yeah, and then how much time am I spending scrolling through Twitter endlessly when I should be doing those?
Yeah, we all know the answer to that.
Yeah, and I think that is an excellent question, and it's definitely the big struggle of my writing life, is balancing those things. As a teacher, I'm basically on a 9-month contract, so it's different for me in the summer right now than it would be during the academic year. But I try to sort of isolate those things. So I have a few days a week when I'm focused on teaching, and then a few days a week when I'm trying to focus on my own writing. But it's never that neat. And also, for me, at least, I find one struggle is it's so easy to, like, go check my email and let someone else give me a problem to solve than it is to, like,
yes,
open Scrivener and say, here's a blank page, now write about something that happened 12 years ago and just start going from there. And that's, I don't have an answer there. I wish, except to say that, like, I think that that is something a lot of us struggle with.
Well, I have one quick question, mainly because you are the founder of Reality Blurred, and you have this fantastic website. It looks like you've got sponsors there, you've got advertising there, you've got a lot of things going on, and reality television is such a huge genre. I'm kind of mystified by how you keep, how you write everything you write on your website, how you keep track of all sort of, you've got a great Twitter feed where you give alerts on sort of what's happening in reality television. And it, from my perspective as a reader of your website and watching your Twitter feed, it looks like a ton of work. So I'm kind of mystified by how you stay on top of all of that and write about all of that, given the day job and the other stuff and all the Twitter scrolling that you have to do.
Yes, exactly. I think it's definitely something that I've kind of learned how to do over time. Like in the early years, it was, I would get up before work like an hour or two, and I would search through like AltaVista, because this was like in the pre-Google days, and try to find stories that I could link to or write about or whatever I was watching the night before. And I think I've just sort of found systems, you know, I think the Twitter scrolling does help, because I follow people and journalists and shows and producers that can clue me on to things. But one thing I've realized is, like, especially now, is there's too much TV for me to follow. I can't do everything. So I just try to have a really basic peripheral awareness. And then I'm okay knowing that I'm only going to focus on certain things that, you know, that are really great and I'd love to share with people, or things that I have a lot of questions about, like what happened on Holy Moly this season, which is my favorite show this summer. And so I can write a deep dive
into
that.
What is it?
It's called Holy Moly. It's an extreme mini golf show on ABC. It's amazing. And it's exactly what I need in the evenings. It's like, you know, you putt a ball through a windmill, and then you try to run through the windmill's blades, and then you get whacked in the head and thrown into a pool of water. And for some reason, that seems to be exactly what I need right now.
Huh. Yeah, I think you've just answered the question of what is my family going to watch now that we've stopped watching Space Force.
Oh, yes. And you have, and there's a whole last season of Holy Moly, too. So you have so much to catch up with. I'm envious.
Excellent.
And, yes.
Yeah, we're on it.
I'm deep into the new season of Alone. I purchased it on Amazon so I could watch it. And this season, they're doing the new, like, $1 million if someone stays 100 days, because no one stayed 100 days. But the thing I like about that show is that there is no camera crew. Of course, the players themselves are. And this is something that, if you've been listening to our podcast for a while, you know I've been hooked on this show since the very, very beginning. So I'm just devouring that show as it comes out.
Yeah, it's great. It's definitely great and very authentic for that reason. It's just a person and a camera and trying to survive by themselves for, like you said, 100 days if they can make it this season. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
All right. In just a minute, we'll talk about what we've been reading. Writers, before we get to what we've been reading, let's talk about what you've been writing, or rather, where you've been writing. Have you got a pile of colored index cards that represent scenes and plot lines and characters and keep getting shuffled around on the floor while your dog walks on them? A notebook full of pages with half an outline here and a list of things that belong in another scene there? I get you. And I want to encourage you to take a look at Dabble, the writing software that works the way our writing minds work, or maybe the way we wish they'd work. Capture all those little details and big plot lines in a system designed to help you keep track of where you are and where you're going. We love Dabble, and we hope you will too. Get a free trial at dabblewriter.com, and please head over to our Facebook group and tell us what you think. Hey, it's KJ, and we've done something new for a few episodes. We've traded some time with a podcast called Bookable. They're going to tell their listeners about us, and we're going to tell you all about them, because they're a podcast we think you're going to enjoy. Bookable is a show that dives into a single book with the author as tour guide. With its engaging sound design, tight interviews, and dynamic music, Bookable is less book report or book club and more like something entirely new, a book exploded into audio form. The podcast cracks open books from nonfiction bestsellers and National Book Award winners to obscure cult classics and works in translation, all in the name of helping you decide what to read next.
hosted by author Amanda Stern, creator and host of the Happy Ending Music and Reading Series at New York City's famous Joe's Pub and Symphony Space, Bookable features authors like Alexander Chi, Mira Jacob, Susan Choi, Julie Oringer, Edgar Caret, and Jennifer Egan, sharing stories both in and around the book with deep dives into how the work came to be. You can find new episodes every Sunday by subscribing to Bookable on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to #AmWriting. We hope you'll check it out, we hope you like it, and we hope you'll let us know what you think. Now let's talk about what we've been reading.
All righty. Do you want to go first, KJ, or would you like our guest to go first?
I would like our guest to go first.
Okay.
So, yeah, this was a tough question because I was thinking, like, maybe like a lot of us over the past few months in the coronavirus era, I've looked at my stack of books and been like, it's time to start reading. And I've just not dived in the way that I really have wished I would have. And then, like, my therapist suggested a book called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. And yeah. I started reading it. And it's
because your therapist wanted you to cheer up.
Well, yes, yeah. It was like, let's think about some. And I think she thought that, like, because I like information, that would be useful. Beautifully written. And I was like, my anxiety was like,
oh, it's amazing.
Nope, go away from this book. Nope, no way.
Yeah. It's amazing, but it's a very, you really can only read that at certain moments in your life.
Like maybe I'll read it in 5 years or something, but right now it's. So what I found, like, kind of like my TV habits, like I've been watching and rewatching a ton of Golden Girls over the past few months, just as they're kind of my coworkers during the day. I've kind of been returning to some old favorites. I'm sort of rereading The Secret History by Donna Tartt. And
that is so weird. That's what we're reading in our family. My college-age son, and now my husband is listening to it, and I just re-listened to it.
Wow. Yeah. And I think it's maybe been like 15 years at least since I read it. So it's been fun to kind of dip back into that. And then I read more recently, I read Lauren Groff's Fates and Furies, and I found myself kind of going back to that again. But even then, I feel like I'm just like, in maybe it's the endless Twitter scrolling that I'm in, but I found myself gravitating more toward kind of bite-sized, shorter pieces. And so my real recommendation here, the thing that I've been reading that I would recommend to others is it's actually via an app called Fresh Ink, and the website is fresh.ink. To get the app. And basically what they do is once a day publish a piece from a literary journal that maybe a lot of journals I've never even heard of. And you can actually set the app to remind you to read at some time of day. So like toward the end of the day when I'm going to look at news and I shouldn't be, because I should be winding down for sleep, I've set it to remind me about 10 o'clock, like, go read a nice...
I like that.
Read a short story.
That is a very good idea.
The app kind of builds in a little discussion feature. So they ask a question after you've read it. I have never answered the question, but other people do. And so there's a little discussion afterwards that seems to have escaped the general toxicity of online comments. And probably because online commenters wouldn't read literary magazines or their, short stories. So highly recommend Fresh Ink. That's been
I would think the troll level of comments beneath selected articles in literary journals by on a site dedicated to literary journals is low.
Yes, extremely.
That's what I love on Twitter. I love long form for that as well. I sort of feel like I get a dose of things I wouldn't find on my own.
Absolutely. Oh, they're great.
KJ, what have you been reading?
Well, I have been sliding out of my usual genre this summer. In part, I think, because I do have more time to read. I'm taking more time to read because I'm forcing myself to spend less time looking at the news and Twitter. And because, the pace of running around as a family has certainly slowed down through reasons that we hate, but I do have more time to read. And as a result, I'm realizing that I don't want to only read the same thing. I mean, I really tend to read light commercial women's fiction, but if you can read three books in a 2 week period, they can't really all be that,
right?
At least not for me. So anyway, I just tried and enjoyed Lucy Foley's The Guest List. So that was a thriller. I'm not usually much of a thriller reader. Set on an island off the coast of Oh, it's so embarrassing.
Ireland.
Thank you. Oh, I wasn't sure if it was Ireland or Scotland.
Yeah, I'm listening to it at the moment. I'm dipping in and out of it. I'll be like totally engaged in it.
It's a very dip in and outable book because it is in so many different voices. Mm-hmm. And I would say that I enjoyed the experience of reading it maybe more than I did the actual ending. But I was happy to have, like, it was a good distracting read, and I felt good about sort of slipping the usual chains of lighthearted romance and stuff like that.
Yeah, and actually I was double checking to make sure it was because I remember them talking about it being like off of Connemara, so I could be England, and I'll have to double check while I'm doing this. But
very rugged, and they frequently talk about the people who are there's accents, but I don't
and you have
remember
to get
what
there,
they identify.
And
the
you have to get
as.
There by ferry. I remember that part, but yeah.
Yep. So. Very important.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's about an entire wedding full of guests all trapped on said island during a storm when, you know, murder strikes. But it's not the usual, here is the body, now that's figuring out who did it. It's structured so that you're experiencing both the discovery of the body and all the events that lead up to the murder at the same time, and it sort of culminates at the very end when the victim and the perpetrator are both discovered in pretty much exactly the same moment. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is Ireland. I just double checked. It is Ireland.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that's good because I'm going in for Ireland again with Sarah Stewart-Taylor. Mountains Wild.
And
that's next on my list.
Both do an incredible job with the atmosphere around the place of, you know, where they're writing about. You're going to love Sarah's book so much. Okay.
Yay.
So I have two books, and one is right along those popular women's fiction. So I started Ellen Hildebrand's new book, The Summer of 69. And at first I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm just not feeling this book. It's just a little, I don't know. And then I kept listening. And that she got me. I cried at the end. And I never cry. I totally cried at the end. And that never happens to me with books. But I was all in. I was absolutely 100% all in with that book. I loved it. And then I have to talk about this other book that I've just started. I'm about a third of the way through it because this also never happens. My dad likes books, and I give him, we have the same taste, which is, you know, like deep dive, informational, research-based nonfiction. And I got him the new book that was getting some raves, I believe on NPR, called The Book of Eels by Patrick Svensson, and it has just been translated into English. And I gave it to my dad along with a bunch of other books, and he basically said, this is one of the best books I have ever read. Oh my gosh, you must read it immediately. It is so good. And it's about eels, yes, but it's like that book. Remember,
that's good, because if it didn't have any eels in it.
Misleading title.
I just feel like that'd be disturbing.
So far, I completely see why my dad felt that way about this book. And this has now stepped up the bar for, like, when I'm purchasing books for my dad, because this book is so good. The Book of Eels, Patrick Svensson, so far, oh my gosh, this book is fantastic. And I had been hearing raves about it from various other places, too. So, yeah, can't recommend it highly enough. All right. Oh my gosh, we got to talk about such cool stuff today.
We did. It was very good. Hey, Andy, tell our guests where they could best follow you. Give them a highlight.
Excellent. So yeah, my website is andydehnart.com. So andydehnart.com. You can find my newsletter there. And then realityblurred.com is the reality TV site, obviously. And I'm also on Twitter under realityblurred if you'd like to follow me there too.
His Twitter feed is super fun.
Thanks.
Awesome.
All right. Well, I'm definitely a new fan. I've loved doing the research for this interview and read all kinds of great stuff. And it has been a pleasure reading your work. We really appreciate having you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you both. And I really appreciate the work you do to keep all of us writers both informed and, you know, motivated, because I've certainly benefited from it. So I hope I've been able to contribute a little bit to that.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Thank you. I think this was great. Yes. Yeah. So, as always, listeners, if you would like the show notes for this episode and every episode to appear in your inbox every week, you can sign up for that at amwritingpodcast.com. Those show notes will always include links to the books, links to our guests, and links to anything else we talk about.
All right. That's it for us this week. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.